each unhappy family. The history of science, like the history of all human ideas, is a history of irresponsible dreams. Karl Popper. She had been born Agnes Googe in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Her mother, Fanny, was not then the high society maven Paul had met. She was a maid. Agnes's father had sailed deep water. Once, when she was 8, she'd received a letter from him. The postmark was Oslo. He'd sketched the serene harbor for her and inquired as to her health. He'd left no address at which to reach him, and she'd never heard from him again. She'd always loved to sing. The upstairs neighbors would bang their boots against the ceiling, but she didn't care. Neither did her mother. When Agnes was 14, Fanny moved into Boston, where she scrubbed floors and polished china plates for the Endicotts while Agnes auditioned for the Bijou. The parts went to local girls whose parents knew the manager. Agnes got a job sweeping stages at the Howard Athenaeum, but it wasn't what she'd imagined. She did not find herself amid a tight-knit group of artists. There was no creative camaraderie in which to conspire. She was the sweeping girl. The singers were the singers, and the stagehands were sauced. It was as much a bordello as a theater. Though a bordello might at least have been profitable. Boston wasn't working. Fanny had seen her daughter's tears, had felt the pain of her unrealized ambitions from the moment they left Michigan. She knew how much Agnes wanted this, and she also knew that the daughters of housemaids didn't become prima donnae. Fanny had to watch her precocious, inquisitive, curious daughter learn cynicism. That was what she could not stand. Agnes had no idea how long her mother had been planning it when it happened. Whether it was a spur-of-the-moment decision or whether her mother had set the whole affair up months before. One day, when she was 17, Agnes came home to find a dress lying across her bed. The dress was of a color that Agnes had never before seen. It was green, bright but somehow still subtle. The shade of orchid leaves, lady's mantle, saxifrage. The shade of a faraway ocean. She gasped when she saw it, when her eyes caught the glimmer of afternoon light from the dirty square window. At the top of the dress, resting delicately over the silk, was a string of diamonds. Agnes stepped closer. She reached out to touch the fabric but pulled her hand back. She was afraid to press her grease-stained fingertips against such a cloth. This dress, these jewels, did not belong to anyone she knew, or anyone she might know. They were a princess's evening wear. "You like it?" Agnes turned to see Fanny in the doorway smoking a thin cigarette.
"What is it?"
"It's a dress," said Fanny. "And it's yours."
"You..."
Agnes couldn't believe what she was going to say.
"You stole it?"
"It comes from the dressing room of Miss Endicott. So do the jewels. The girl is about your age, a little younger. It might be a little wide around the bust, but we can take it in."
"You stole a dress from Mary Endicott?"
Agnes was dumbfounded, terrified. The family would discover the loss, and her mother had been polishing their silver for just long enough to be the first likely suspect. The police would be at their door within days. That's when her mother explained. They were going to leave Boston, and they were going to do it that very night. They would take a coach steamer to Paris, packing the dress in their valise. Agnes would board the steamer in her normal clothes, and she would disembark in green silk. She would leave Boston Harbor as a sweeping girl, and she would arrive in Paris, the daughter of New California money. "Miss Agnes Huntington," her mother had said. "Doesn't that sound nice?"
I don't know who that is,
Agnes had protested. Exactly. No one does. But soon enough, everyone will. With only an impossibly expensive dress and a string of gems, the teenage Agnes would be reborn in Paris. There she could be anyone she wanted. There were enough moneyed Huntingtons roaming the world that no one would be sure from which line she'd descended. And, if she worked her manners, no one would be rude enough to ask. Agnes was beautiful, her mother had explained. She was radiant, she was funny. She was both smart and clever, which were never quite the same thing, and she was enormously talented. The only thing holding her back in America was her family.
But what about you?
Fanny would be there as well. Waiting in the wings, silent and unseen, Fanny would be backstage awaiting her daughter's triumph. The police wouldn't be able to find her in Paris. They'd never looked that far afield. But they would most certainly be looking. The Endicotts were not a family to be trifled with. So forever, even if their deceit were to be successful, Fanny would have to stay in her daughter's shadow.
I'm afraid.
I know, her mother had answered. But I love you. And that's why we're going to do this. Fanny had moved close and kissed Agnes once on her forehead. And then Fanny had packed both of their bags while Agnes puttered and paced, too shocked to argue or do anything but what she'd been asked. They boarded the Cunard Line steamer bound for Europe that very evening. And that was the last anyone had ever seen of Agnes or Fanny Googe. In steerage, Agnes kept the dress hidden for the duration of the trip, clutching her bag even while she slept. Only on that final morning had her mother removed the green cloth from its cover. The other women in the steerage cabin were incredulous. Agnes and Fanny said nothing. Agnes had heard of a cafe from some men on the boat, gentlemen from the first-class cabin whom she passed as they smoked on the communal deck. It sounded, from the snatches of description she'd been able to overhear, like a good place for introductions. On her second day in Paris, she left the cheap women's boarding house Fanny had found and asked for directions. Agnes sat with her café au lait along the Boulevard Saint-Marcel, wearing a high-society evening gown and matching necklace at 11 in the morning. But after 20 minutes, she was approached by a tall man with slick black hair and an old wool coat. He was actually quite handsome. He addressed her in French, which, of course, she did not speak.
"Pardon," she said. "Would you like to try that in English?"
"Your touch overdress for the morning."
She looked him up and down.
"I should say you'd be better off with a bit of dressing up yourself."
The man laughed at her insult and helped himself to the seat opposite. There was a party the following night. There was always a party, she would learn. He invited her, and when she accepted, he asked where he might claim her on the evening in question.
"Why, right here, of course," she answered. "Won't you want a cup before a long night out?
Unless," she added, "you don't think it's going to be a very long night." He assured her that it was. And when he came to pick her up in his two-horse carriage the next evening, she found that he wasn't wrong. If he noticed that she was wearing the same green dress as on the day before, he made no comment about it. She would come to learn that his sort never did. It took her only three more parties before she found someone to buy her another dress. His name was Coulter, and he was friendly with Monsieur Jacques Doucet himself. Surely she'd appreciate a little something from his shop. Her collection of gowns grew in direct proportion with her collection of gentlemen admirers. A silk baron, a minor aristocrat of the old order, a German banker who found himself frequently in Paris at the house of Lazard. None needed any prompting to send her a little something. Her mother was her only female companion in that first year. The women of Paris society were competitive, and they could smell a rat, even when their brothers and husbands and fathers could not. But what were they to do except to exclude Agnes from their teas? To gossip about her incessantly? To keep her name on their lips in snide and disparaging tones? She returned nightly to her mother, who'd given her everything, and who'd received nothing yet in return. If the social intrigue stung on occasion, the pain was easily balmed by the singing. Agnes made her debut during a party at Thomas Hench's mansion. The crowd was more than receptive, and her name was passed around. First she sang at parties, and then an offer came to sing at the Théâtre du Châtelet. When she closed her eyes mid-song, when she felt the air in her throat and the rapt audience before her, it was everything she'd ever imagined. If she could ignore the circumstances of her arrival, she was at home. People said that Agnes could bring even the most stoic of audiences to tears with her voice. If that was true, it was because she knew of what she sang. After a year, the Huntingtons decamped for London. Agnes used the reputation she'd built up in Paris to arrive fully formed across the Channel. And this time, her mother arrived to meet her from California. They had enough money at this point for even Fanny to acquire the accoutrements of society. The West End theater owners clamored to book Agnes before she'd even arrived. She and Fanny passed a few successful years there. The Earl of Harewood had taken a fancy to her. She'd taken a lovely sail with the Duke of Fife, and then back to Paris, where she was hailed as a returning champion. After touring Europe, Agnes returned to Boston at the age of 21 as the toast of the continent. She was welcomed with open arms into the opera houses and parlor rooms of the Back Bay, rooms that she would never have been able to enter before. And she went unrecognized, as did Fanny. Who would even remember a poor, sad, sweeping girl named Agnes Googe? Agnes Huntington was the toast of the European elite to which all American classes aspired. A certain green dress and its accompanying diamonds had long been sold off. Fanny stayed away from the parties, away from the opening nights. She stayed very far away from the Endicotts. Her face went unseen in Boston society, even as her name was mentioned frequently in connection with Agnes's. They'd gotten away with it. The life that Agnes had won became so full that she believed it herself. She had not succumbed to cynicism. She had grown into the woman she'd dreamed. The talent of Agnes Huntington, the things that made her a star of the stage and a belle of the ball, were wholly real. No one else had made her who she was. And though she'd lied to get there, it was not the lies that echoed from the walls of the Metropolitan Opera House every night. It was the truth. The lie had only granted her a fair shot. She owed nothing to anyone except for one person. And that was a debt she would repay every day. Was Fanny difficult, controlling, omnipresent? Of course. Did Agnes relish the occasional night out? The infrequent tipsy moment where she might be free of the perfect caution her mother expected of her? Well, of course. But if she resented her mother's wrath on occasion, that did not mean that she didn't love her. Fanny had given her everything. Why are you telling me all this? Because I haven't told anyone else, she said. And I thought, I wanted you to know why this is so important, why I have to. That's why your mother wants you married into the Janes.
She's worried that one day this will all catch up to you. That someone will recognize Agnes Googe in the face of Agnes Huntington. She held his gaze. And that's why you hired me in the first place. It wasn't just about Foster making up stories. You could have handled that yourselves. You were worried he might start digging into your past. If your identity was exposed, all of this, everything you've done, would be for nothing. Her smile was sad. Unless you have some manner of protection, concluded Paul. Agnes Huntington is susceptible to accusation. But Agnes Jane is not. Paul had to admire the brilliance of their plan. No one would dare confront you. Even if the Endicotts found you, they wouldn't possibly suggest anything. They'd be eaten alive by the Janes. To go up against the Janes, she said, would be like going up against Thomas Edison. Only a fool would attempt it. A fool like me? Or like our eccentric friend in there? Paul knew more than ever that he could never marry her. She deserved a peace that he could never afford. Did she care for him? Is that why she'd made her confession? He didn't know. Could she? He hoped so. But because he knew he cared for her, he let those hopes recede into the starlit night. Paul reached out and took her hand. He hadn't decided to do it, it just happened. Their fingers intertwined suddenly. He wasn't sure if he'd wrapped his fingers around hers or if it was the other way around. Her skin felt warm. Sometimes I hate it so much, she said, always having to pretend. Paul gripped her fingers tighter. This is America, he said. We're all pretending. He looked up at the clear night sky. His eyes naturally traced the constellations among the bright stars. Dipper, Orion, Cassiopeia. He'd been spotting their hidden shapes from this very place since he was a boy. Yet the irony of constellations was that their shapes were but narratives imposed by an active mind. The brightest design among the heavens was in truth only what you imagined it to be. Glance across the stars differently, and the figures they formed were suddenly different as well. Blink once, and you could draw the lines between them into anything you chose. He leaned in and kissed her. Chapter 47 The Morning After. I do not think you can name many great inventions that have been made by married men. Nikola Tesla. The next morning was a strange one. Paul woke late, having slept fitfully on the downstairs couch. When he lifted his head from the stiff pillows, he could already smell the coffee boiling in its tin pot. By the time he'd dressed and made his way to the kitchen, he found Agnes and Erastus engaged in conversation. The mood was casual, familial. Paul attempted to read Agnes. He thought of her lips, her fingers, the feeling of her body pressed against his as they held each other close. When she looked at him in the kitchen, did her mind race to such scenes too? In her smile, he found no clues. She said her hello, smiled warmly, and then turned back to Erastus's discussion of Tesla. Erastus had ideas about the peculiar nature of Tesla's mind. Teresa of Avila had suffered similar hallucinations. Might Tesla be blessed with a divine sight as she had been? They passed the morning in conversation with Paul's parents until heading off to catch their noon train. After they had said farewell to Tesla and Ruth, Erastus took Paul and Agnes to the station in silence before offering his typically formal goodbye. Paul spent a few cents on newspapers and a baked bun as they waited on the platform. He needed to say something about the previous night, but he didn't know what. Or how. Should he apologize? Should he admit to having been ungentlemanly, given that she was soon to be engaged? Or should he tell her, one time, just so that the words might be loosed into the air, that he was in love with her? "Miss Huntington," said Paul, fumbling. "I mean, Agnes..." "He's proud of you, you know," she said. "What?" he asked. "Your father is terribly proud of you, whether you realize it or not." Clearly, his family had made some sort of impression on her. Perhaps, Paul thought, in the absence of her own family, she looked longingly to his. Paul scoffed. "I find that hard to believe."
"You think that he's cold?"
"I think that when he is reminded I exist, I am a terrible disappointment to him."
"How often has he come to see you in New York?"
Paul considered. "Once, on Fisk business."
"Or maybe that's how he put it to you."
"Why wouldn't he just tell me he wanted to see me?"
"God, you're so manlike. Listen, did you ever think that perhaps he doesn't think you're proud of him?"
The suggestion was absurd. "What in the world are you talking about?"
"You were the one who left Paul, not him. Imagine how he felt about that."
"What did he think I was going to do?
Teach at Fisk? Preach in Nashville? He thinks you are the one who rejected him, and it's your approval for which he is wanting."
"That makes no sense at all. How could he think that?"
"Because," said Agnes, as if it were the most obvious thing in the world, "the two of you are pretty much exactly alike."
Paul was quiet. No one had ever compared him to his father before.
"You should tell him," she said.
"That I'm proud of him, that you respect him, that he's a good man and an admirable one, and that you've always known that. That he's your family, and New York is just the place you've chosen to live." Paul thought about this. How could Agnes, who'd met the man only the day before, know his father better than he did? "I'll try." This seemed enough for her. "And about last night," she said.
"There's nothing you need to say, nothing I expect you to do. This is where we are, this is who we are. I wish things were different, and I know you do too.
I'm sorry that I kissed you."
"I'm not."
And then they both looked down. The feeling was too great to handle politely. Paul looked at the newspaper stand beside him. A small headline below the middle fold instantly grabbed his attention. Paul turned to the signboard that announced the schedule of arrivals and departures.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "I have to go. There's a train in 5 minutes."
His mind was a jumble. Agnes looked confused.
"The number 5 doesn't leave for almost an hour."
"I'm going to Buffalo." He grabbed the newspaper and obliviously overpaid the boy behind the counter. "Look, there's been a murder. The article says that a Mr. William Kemmler of Buffalo has just been convicted of butchering his wife with an axe." Agnes frowned as she read.
"So?"
"So, if he is sentenced to death, then he'll be executed with an AC-powered electrical chair." She looked up at him, knowing full well what this would mean for Paul and for Tesla.
"Go," she said.
He stood.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "I wanted to...
I should say..." She waved him off.
"Go."
"Goodbye, Miss Huntington," he said as he grabbed his luggage. His formality felt instantly ridiculous.
"You'll be all right getting back to the city on your own."
"I think I can manage just fine, Mr. Cravath." He ran across the station. Chapter 48. The Hatchet Man in Buffalo. We can't blame the technology when we make mistakes. Tim Berners-Lee. "If it please the court," said Paul in his most lawyerly baritone,
The use of an electrical device for performing an execution is not...
And I object again, Your Honor, said Harold Brown. You have already ruled on the issue of this technology's fitness for use in capital punishment, and Mr. Cravath is attempting to relitigate.
And you see, sir, not only am I not relitigating, but that's not even what relitigate means. I would again like to object to Mr. Brown conducting this hearing without a proper lawyer present. Both of you be quiet, barked Judge Day, already annoyed at how the day had been progressing. Paul had at first been surprised that Edison hadn't arranged for one of his real attorneys to handle this motion and had instead allowed Brown to run the show himself. It was certainly a show, though Paul realized that that was perhaps the point. To the public, Edison still remained removed from Brown and the grim business of the electrical chair. The only thing was that Brown wasn't an attorney at all. Arguing with him was like arguing with a half-informed child. The legal community had discussed requiring that prospective lawyers pass a proficiency exam, but such proposals remained purely talk. One did not need to take any sort of test to practice law in New York. Brown had gotten a friendly firm to attest that he'd spent some time apprenticing with a local attorney, and that was enough for Judge Day. Harold Brown had every right to sit at the desk opposite Paul's and argue that William Kemmler should be executed by means of AC. Mr. Cravath, said the judge, I'm not going to waste time hearing arguments on this issue again. It is not my intention to rehash any of those arguments. So then what is your intention? Asked the judge. Simply to point out that even if New York State has the right to electrocute a man with alternating current, the state lacks the equipment to do so. The judge looked bewildered. This was not a line of argument that he'd anticipated. How do you mean? It's quite simple. The only company producing AC electrical generators in New York State is the Westinghouse Electric Company, and my client has never sold a generator to the state of New York. Furthermore, my client has no intention of doing so. I would suggest that if you're keen on killing him with electricity, the state has no choice but to employ direct current.
That is absurd, yelled Brown. Direct current is far too low voltage. It cannot possibly be...
Quiet, interrupted Judge Day once again. Mr. Cravath has made an excellent point, but I will interrogate further. Cannot the state simply purchase a Westinghouse generator from one of the many citizens of New York who own one? I cannot imagine Mr. Brown here would have a hard time finding someone willing to sell.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, said Paul. I'm sure that Mr. Brown could browbeat a man into selling his firstborn. I'm sure he could get someone to sell him or the state an AC generator. The problem is only that in such eventuality the seller has no legal right to sell, and the buyer no legal right to make use of his purchase.
Paul took a sheaf of papers from his desk and approached the judge's bench. If it please the court, these are the bill of sale and licensing deals that the Westinghouse Electric Company makes with each purchaser of one of its AC generators. Mostly these are small towns or neighborhoods. Occasionally a wealthy individual with a lot of ground to cover. This is what makes AC so valuable. It covers many multiples the distance of DC. But I digress. As you'll see, the standard language of this contract clearly states that the purchaser of one of these devices is forbidden from selling the device to a third party. We've aimed from the very beginning to make sure that Westinghouse devices have not gotten into the wrong hands. But, as it prevents third-party resale, it thus also means that if anyone were to sell their AC unit to the state of New York without the Westinghouse Electric Company's written approval, which I can assure you they won't receive, they'd be doing so in violation of their license to operate the unit in question, which means that the state would possess the unit illegally and would not be legally permitted to turn it on. Judge Day read over the documents he'd been given. The language was clear-cut and ironclad. Carter and Hughes had written them. If Brown knew enough legal terminology to understand the contract, he'd quickly see that he'd lost. Paul returned to his desk with a sense of satisfaction. His work with Westinghouse had not produced a great deal of success in the legal realm. It was nice, for once, to have a victory.
I've only one thing to add, said Harold Brown. To clarify the situation that Mr. Cravath has described?
Yes,
asked Judge Day. What if I was already in possession of one of Mr. Westinghouse's AC units? A unit that I did have the legal right to sell to our friends in the state legislature.
My client has never sold you an AC unit, I can promise you that. Any document you produce that might show such a thing would be a forgery.
I agree with you, sir. The Westinghouse Electric Company has never and will never sell either my agents or me a licensed AC system.
All right.
But the same cannot be said for all of Mr. Westinghouse's licensees. While Paul had recuperated at Bellevue, Carter and Hughes had helped Westinghouse to license local manufacturers to build and distribute his electrical systems. Those local shops were their own corporations which paid royalties to Westinghouse on the equipment they sold. They were also supposed to use the sales contracts that Westinghouse provided them, the contracts that Carter and Hughes had drawn up. If one had crafted its own language, it would have had to do so specifically for the purpose of double-crossing Westinghouse. This would have to have been planned ages ago, a Trojan horse in Westinghouse operations. A small, round man stood up from the gallery. All eyes in the courtroom turned to see him walk down the center aisle and up to Harold Brown's desk.
If it please the court, said Charles Coffin as he stood beside Brown, I am the president of the Thompson-Houston Electric Company. I am a licensee for the Westinghouse Electric Company, and I have the right to sell generators to whomever I choose.
Paul turned to face the man he'd last seen in his own offices on the day he'd returned from Bellevue.
This is a bill of sale, said Coffin, for one AC generator from my company to Harold Brown. It grants him the right to resell this device to whomever he chooses on whatever terms he chooses, and the paperwork was drawn up by my people, not by Mr. Cravath or his partners.
Coffin winked at Paul, who couldn't believe what he was seeing. His face flushed with anger. Thompson-Houston depended on Westinghouse for the entirety of its business, for its very survival. At this betrayal, Westinghouse would cut all ties to Coffin's company. What was Coffin thinking? Unless Coffin was realigning his company. He was switching sides.
I am quite certain, Your Honor, said Paul, that as soon as next week, the Thompson-Houston Electric Company will announce that it's switching from AC to DC and that it's partnering with Edison. I have no doubt that Mr. Coffin will be well compensated for this betrayal.
I don't believe my dealings with Edison General Electric have a thing to do with today's proceedings, and of course my business is no longer any of yours.
It didn't take long for Judge Day to go over the documents, or to rule that they did, in fact, promise exactly what Coffin and Brown said they promised. A few minutes later, Paul had lost. Yet again.
It was a good try,
said Harold Brown as they all left the courtroom.
But not quite good enough.
I will make it my mission to see that neither of you gets away with this, said Paul.
Really?
Said Coffin with a smile.
How?
Paul opened his mouth to speak, but found himself without a suitable retort. He didn't have a move to make.
Oh, added Brown, and you may consider that payback for my office door. Did you really have to kick the goddamned thing down?
Chapter 49. The Execution of William Kemmler. Sometimes when you innovate, you make mistakes. It is best to admit them quickly and get on with improving your other innovations. Steve Jobs. On August 6, 1889, William Kemmler was to be executed upon a chair designed by Harold Brown. The chair would be wired up to an AC generator. The generator had been theorized by Nikola Tesla, perfected and integrated into a functional system by George Westinghouse, and then manufactured by Charles Coffin.
It would soon send over 1,000 volts of alternating current into William Kemmler. Brown had the gall to arrange invitations for both Westinghouse and Paul. Westinghouse threw out the letter. Edison would not attend either, of course. He'd made a few public comments about the brouhaha in Buffalo, but he remained steadfastly uninvolved. Reporters who wrote about the controversy surrounding the debate between DC and AC asked him whether he thought Westinghouse's current would get the job done. Edison answered that Westinghouse's current was a dreadful thing and was fit for little else besides murder, which left Paul to attend the execution alone. He felt that someone on his side should be there. Paul had seen grisly scenes before. He'd even seen a death by electricity in the air above Broadway a year ago. He wasn't one to shy from the grotesque. If this was to be the end, Paul had no intention of covering his eyes. Paul arrived at the New York State Prison in Auburn at 6 a.m. A crowd had already gathered outside the gates. Reporters awaited the first news they could fire away to their editors. Citizens hoped for a glimpse of the dead killer. Paul muscled his way through the commotion. He was recognized by a few of the reporters. He didn't want to talk to anyone, especially the press. Inside the prison gates, Paul was led to a basement newly renovated for the proceedings. The walls had been painted, the windows polished, a fresh set of chairs brought in for the viewing gallery. Paul noticed 2 gas lamps along the walls. He almost laughed. They didn't need lighting. The morning sunshine poured into the clean basement from 2 tall windows. 30 or so guests took their seats. There was little chit-chat. Most of the men were physicians come to see for themselves what the strange current did to human flesh. 2 reporters had been granted attendance. The prison warden had personally selected them. A few criminal lawyers, the district attorney, and Kemmler's court-appointed defense lawyer represented the legal community. Judge Day was there, and so was Harold Brown. "Good morning, counselor," he said to Paul. Paul took a chair a few rows behind Brown, at the back of the audience. This was not a performance at which one wanted orchestra seats. It was near 6:30 when a pair of prison guards led the condemned man into the sunny basement. Paul realized that he'd never even seen Kemmler before. He didn't look like an axe murderer, or not like what Paul might imagine an axe murderer to be. He was small, with a close-cropped beard and narrow eyes. He looked thin, as if the prison food had not been to his liking. His hair was dark, and his 3-piece suit was a perfect summer gray. The chair itself was quite simple. Just a tall-backed oak chair, of a dark and average color. The seat was lined with leather. Leather, too, were the straps across the arms. "Gentlemen," said Kemmler to the assembled, "I wish you all good luck. I know where I am headed, and I know that it is a good place. I can only hope the same will be true of you." Kemmler removed his jacket. He folded it gingerly and placed it on an unused chair. He took the chair at the center of the room. "Now there's no rush, so take your time and make sure you do the job right." The 2 guards placed electrodes on Kemmler's back. To do so, they had to cut holes in his white shirt. He sighed as they did. The electrodes were attached to long wires that swept up toward the ceiling and ran into the wall. The AC generator required to power the electric chair was big, and it was loud, and so a decision had been made to keep it in a distant room. When it was time to turn the crank, the warden was to use a bell to send a signal to the men operating the generator. The guards used the leather straps to bind Kemmler's body. First his legs, then his stomach, then his forearms and biceps. A headpiece was fit atop his skull. It was of the same matching leather, except for a wet sponge that fit into Kemmler's mouth. After the sponge held down his tongue, the headpiece would hold his jaw tight. He wouldn't be able to scream.
"All right, then," said the warden as he stepped back.
Paul looked to Brown, who had the face of a child on Christmas morning and was tapping his shoes on the wooden floor. Paul already felt ill. His stomach was churning even before the horror began. But he would not shut his eyes. He was going to take in every detail. If he could accumulate enough precious and terrible facts, just maybe they would get him through. Without any more preamble, the warden rang the bell. The ding was sharp and clear. The warden repeated it a few times so that there could be no ambiguity. It was time for Kemmler to die. Suddenly, the prisoner's body shivered. The switch had clearly been thrown in the adjacent room, and 1,000 volts of AC raced through him. His muscles tightened, his hands fluttered in the air, trying to escape his bonds. As Westinghouse had shown Paul in the lab, the AC did not make the body inert. Kemmler's muscles were not permanently clenched. He would have been able to get up if only the leather straps were not holding him tight. Westinghouse's AC system would have been perfectly safe had not Brown and Coffin conspired to make a version of it specifically designed to kill. Paul saw Kemmler's right-hand index finger curl up into itself. His nails convulsed against his palm so violently that he drew blood from his own hand. And that was it. The current ran through Kemmler for 17 seconds before the warden again rang the bell and the men in the generator room turned off their machine. All of the assembled took a breath. It was done. Paul looked to Brown, who seemed ready to applaud. Paul stood. Some summer air would be helpful. But just as he got to his feet, he heard a strange noise. It was faint. It was coming from the direction of the electric chair. Everyone else seemed to hear it, too. All heads turned to look. The noise was coming from William Kemmler. Blood continued to drip from his hands. His head rocked side to side, his chest moved up and down, the air seeping back into his lungs. He was mumbling, trying to say something through the charred sponge. "Oh, dear God," someone said. Horror spread across each man's face as he realized that Kemmler was still alive. Paul saw a white froth coming out of the man's mouth. He was trying to breathe. What unimaginable state must his inner organs be in? The warden quickly took control of the situation. He bade the men to again be seated and rang his bell furiously. They would try again. The current again zapped through Kemmler. But this second attempt proved no more successful than the first. The prisoner heaved against his restraints, every muscle in his body tensing and releasing and tensing again. The sponge in his mouth began to fry, like blackening chicken in an iron pan. Paul saw the faintest whiff of smoke rise from his hair to the ceiling. William Kemmler was burning alive. But he still didn't die. Not this second time. To the embarrassment of the warden and to the great horror of the witnesses. Nor did he die on the third try, either. By the fourth attempt, the protests from the guests had grown forceful.
"My God, man," said one of the physicians. "You must make this stop. This is torture."
It was impossible to disagree. Even the reporters had joined in, pleading with the warden to end this barbarism. But this was the law. The warden's duty was to follow its letter. He had instructions from the office of the governor himself. He intended to carry them out. Harold Brown got up and approached the warden. They shared a brief whispered conversation. It seemed as if Brown was offering to consult, He was ever eager to play the role of inventor. But the warden shook his head and quickly sent Brown back to his seat. This was an affair of the state. The current again entered Kemmler's body. The prisoner raged against the leather straps with such force that his skin began ripping off. His mouth and eyes grew black from char. Blood no longer dripped from his hand, but rather poured in a bright gush. Dark smoke rose from his head. And then, quite suddenly, blue fire shot from Kemmler's mouth. Paul watched as the same blue hellfire he'd seen above that street in Manhattan incinerated Kemmler's skull, lit his hair on fire, and then washed across his body. It stripped the skin from his bones. The guests jumped to their feet as the blood flew across the basement. Paul was among the men sprinting for the door. In the prison yard, the first thing Paul did was vomit. Without food in his stomach, what came up was just a bitter clot of bile. He knelt in the dirt, spitting the taste from his lips. Paul looked up at his fellow witnesses. He wasn't the only one being sick. The physicians, more accustomed to gore, had lit cigarettes. They were talking animatedly, trying to figure out what they had just witnessed. They'd never seen a body do that before. Their personal horror was tinged with professional curiosity. The reporters were scribbling in their notebooks. Paul realized that within minutes they would file reports of what they'd witnessed, a scene they would paint for the many newspapers across the country. The Westinghouse system of alternating current had just proven itself to be a spectacularly poor instrument of murder. If Edison and Brown had wanted to demonstrate the stubborn safety of alternating current, they could have done no better job. Paul still felt ill. But for the first time in a long while, he also felt like his side had won something. Paul turned to see Brown exiting quickly through the prison gates. He thought he could make out dark stains on Brown's linen jacket. And on his hands as well. Chapter 50. When London trembles, New York quakes. An investment in knowledge pays the best interest. Benjamin Franklin. George Westinghouse was in his shirt sleeves when Paul burst through the double doors of his private study. Paul felt a little bashful about his excitement considering the previous day's events. And yet, an unrepentant axe murderer had been punished and his death had exposed to the public the extent of Edison's lies about alternating current. No one could now believe that alternating current was particularly lethal. The question was already being asked in the papers. Had Brown been simply mistaken, or had he been lying? And if the latter, why? Paul had not often been able to relay such good news to his client. Mr. Cravath? Westinghouse checked his pocket watch. Sir, I telegrammed. The news from Buffalo, surely you've seen it. Proudly, Paul removed the day's New York Times from his coat pocket. He slapped the paper down on Westinghouse's desk. The headline blared in 48-point type across the top of the thin broadsheet, "Electrical Atrocity in Buffalo. Is Edison to Blame?" "The papers are all looking into Edison," said Paul. "They all are reporting that Brown was a fraud, and someone had to have put him up to it." Westinghouse said nothing. He looked down at the newspaper, taking it into his hands and giving the headlines a long, hard stare. "This is good," said Westinghouse. "Yes, this is good," said Paul. This wasn't quite the reaction he had hoped for. "Your current is too safe to be of any use in executions. They could barely kill a man with the stuff when they tried. Every newspaper in the country is reporting the story in the same terms. AC is too safe. The scandal is no longer about the worrisome dangers of your current. It's about your current's worrisome safety."
"We'll sell more units. We'll sell a lot more units."
Paul was perplexed by his client's muted response. Sales of AC systems had been slowing of late. This was just the thing to reinvigorate buyers. This should have been a long-awaited moment of triumph. But Westinghouse looked as if the two men were at a wake.
"We'll need to," said Westinghouse as he set the paper down and sat back in his chair. "We're bankrupt."
He said it so abruptly that Paul wasn't quite sure what he meant.
"What?" "Well, not quite yet. But soon. Very soon."
"I don't understand."
Sales had slowed, but they hadn't slowed enough for that. "Perhaps you've been reading the wrong papers," suggested Westinghouse as he took a folded paper from under some letters on the other side of his desk. He placed the thin newspaper down on top of Paul's New York Times. It was the Wall Street Journal. "When London trembles, New York quakes." The subheading was less sensationalistic and more descriptive. Rumors spread across Atlantic of Baring Brothers' collapse. The second subhead then added helpfully, "Banking house among world's oldest may fall on Argentine bond loss. What does this mean for U.S.?"
"It is the damned Argentines," said Westinghouse. "Everyone thought it was a solid bet at the time."
Paul took the journal from the desk and quickly scanned the left-hand column. From what he could gather, the reporting was nothing more than hearsay. Unidentified and unsourced rumors. Certain suggestions had grown louder in recent days, and these suggestions were that the Baring Brothers Bank in London might soon crash. Since this was an institution that had withstood 120 years of financial turmoil, if Baring Brothers had a problem, it was likely not alone. If the Bank of England itself were to be questioned, the article said, it could not carry a more severe shock. There was more technical information about the nature of the Argentine deal, a South American recession, a bubble in Brazil, a ripple on one continent that would become a tidal wave when it reached another. "How does this spell our bankruptcy?" asked Paul. "The Barings don't own this company."
"But how many of our creditors are now soon to be theirs?"
Paul began to understand the problem.
"Your creditors are going to demand repayment of their loans sooner than anticipated."
"A lot sooner than anticipated," replied Westinghouse as he gestured toward a letter on his desk. "That's from A.J. Cassart. He would like his loans repaid by this coming Friday."
"Christ. It's Tuesday."
"Did you read that in the paper, too?"
"How much?"
"Hard to say. But this letter will not be the last of its kind that I received this week. I have been going over our numbers. It's no secret that we operate at a loss. Under normal circumstances, this is not a problem. Most growing businesses employ the same tactics."
"How much debt are we in?"
"You, Mr. Cravath, are not in any debt at all. I am in debt for approximately $3 million.
"And what are the assets of the company?"
"All told, approximately $2.5 million.
Paul began to pace the room, considering the problem. "So, we'll need to raise at least $500,000 in capital in order to convince your creditors not to seize the company."
"I'm glad to see you've been practicing your mathematics."
Paul stopped pacing by the ceiling-high bookshelves on the far side of the room. He turned to face Westinghouse. "It's not you who is in debt. It is your company, so that's the first thing. It's not on you alone."
"You're mistaken," said Westinghouse.
"What are you talking about?"
"I've put up this house and everything in it as collateral. It might not be worth a full $500,000, but it's no tenement."
Paul knew George Westinghouse had always taken the affairs of his company quite personally. It was named after him, and he treated the corporation as an extension of his own corpus. But it was one thing to do so emotionally. It was another to endanger the roof over his wife's head. Seeing the expression on Paul's face, Westinghouse smiled with a stubborn naivete.
You think this is a grave mistake, suggested Westinghouse.
Sir, it's your family, said Paul.
Am I in for one of your speeches? They're quite good, kid, I'll give you that. But if your aim is to convince me to simply let my company fall without placing every ounce of weight I have underneath it as support, well, not even you are that eloquent.
Paul knew his argument would lose.
The first thing he had learned about persuading others was how to determine when, and of what, they were capable of being persuaded. On that day, he knew Westinghouse would not be moved. And so he also knew that the only way to save his client was to stave off this bankruptcy himself.
Chapter 51. Apologetic Millionaires.
You have to learn the rules of the game, and then you have to play better than anyone else. Albert Einstein. Over the next few weeks, Paul and Westinghouse took turns making penitent pilgrimages to the most moneyed of the New York money men. The stations of their cross were formed by Wall Street, Union Square, and Madison Square. Not a millionaire was spared their devotionals. Westinghouse forswore his company's sins. The financial promiscuity would come to an end. The firm's governance was pledged to frugality. In their pleas, the men asked for more than mere blessings. They asked for absolution. Research into newer and more elaborate products would be halted, with a focus fixed solely upon improving the manufacture and cost-effectiveness of existing devices. They were without the bottomless war chest that J.P. Morgan provided Edison, and so their culture was naturally quite different. They did not aim to be some manner of pie-in-the-sky idea factory. Westinghouse worked. The company would continue to make things, and they would be the highest quality electrical products in the world. That had always been their goal, and it always would be. Even the program to develop a new light bulb far afield of Edison's would be abandoned. They could not continue to afford the manpower on a task that had, after a year, borne no progress at all. Westinghouse's engineers were good, but they were expensive, and not one of them was Nikola Tesla. The immediate survival of the company was at stake. They would need only a moderate injection of capital to keep things going through the coming winter. The few hundreds of thousands of dollars they required to maintain operations were small beer compared to the fortunes to be generated by electric light. But every time Paul and Westinghouse concluded their practiced supplications, they were reminded by the apologetic millionaires across from them that this all depended on a victory over Edison. From the safety of their glazed oak desks, the bankers were quick to suggest that if direct current became the standard of the day, then the Westinghouse Electric Company would play little part in the prosperity. The problem was not with the frugality or operational efficiency of the company. It was with the fragility of its very existence. Who would profit from providing expensive medicine to a man whose illness was already terminal? They did experience moments of success. Fresh investments were secured from Hugh Garden, A.T. Rowand, and William Scott, extending the company's life by a few frenzied weeks. Carter and Hughes lent their extensive connections to the cause, producing a much-needed $130,000 just a week into the crisis. It bought them another month. Paul was able to scrape together a few days of survival here and there through his Columbia network. These were the terms in which they now measured. Not in dollars and cents, but in weeks, days, even hours. $1 million could buy a year. $1,000 barely afforded a day. By unanimous vote, the firm of Carter, Hughes, and Cravath decided to defer their legal fees until after the crisis was over. To be sure, the dues owed them continued to mount. They dutifully recorded their labors in the leather-bound ledger they kept for such a purpose, scribbling every meeting, every letter, every late evening beneath the office gas lamps. The right-hand column of their book filled with imaginary dollars.
who knew if they would ever be paid. As the firm, as Paul, built a theoretical fortune,